This week on the Best of Flashpoints, violence continues to expand across Iraq as the U.S. occupation grinds on. We'll hear from our special correspondent, Ahmed Habib. Also, Israeli forces target Palestinian justice activists while empowered Israeli settler groups continue to attack Palestinian homes across the West Bank and inside Israel as well. Novelist Susan Abulhawa talks about her novel, which illustrates the ongoing struggle of Palestinian refugees. Evelina Molina speaks with Arnaldo Garcia about the federal crackdown on immigrants, focusing on draconian policies in Arizona at the U.S.-Mexico border. And a transgender community activist speaks out about sexual assault by police and the criminalization of sexuality in New Orleans. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Amidst a stumbling theater of U.S.-supported vote recounts and claims of voter fraud in U.S.-occupied Iraq, violence across the country continues to unfold. An American-led series of airstrikes over the weekend killed several people in an operation that U.S. officials claimed was a targeted attack on what they call al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Washington Post reported, quote, "In Washington, Vice President Joe Biden declared that the operation demonstrated the growing strength of the Iraqi security forces. Quote, the Iraqis led this operation," Biden told reporters, adding that Iraqis also gathered the intelligence that led to the targeting. Quote, "In short, the Iraqis have taken the lead." White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs described the United States as playing a supporting role. That from the Washington Post. These U.S. attacks follow a series of car bomb attacks over 5 days last week in Baghdad, in which nearly 140 people were killed and hundreds wounded. Meanwhile, Jeremy Scahill reports in The Nation that officials within the infamous mercenary security company Blackwater have been indicted for weapons violations, including conspiracy to violate a series of federal gun laws, obstruction of justice, and making false statements. Scahill reports, quote, "The weapons charges stem from Blackwater's purchase of 227 short barrels for use within the company's government-issued M4 rifles in Iraq and Afghanistan, a violation of State Department weapons guidelines for contractors. Former Blackwater employees have alleged in sworn affidavits that Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, had used his personal planes to smuggle banned weapons into Iraq, sometimes wrapping them in large shipments of dog food for the company's K-9 teams in Iraq. Prince, however, is not named in the indictment. That's Jeremy Scahill writing in The Nation. Joining us to talk about the current situation in U.S.-occupied Iraq and the region is our special correspondent, Ahmed Habib. Ahmed is a journalist and poet and writes for Al Jazeera and the Electronic Intifada, among others. He joins us from Doha. Ahmed, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Nora. Thank you so much for having me back on. It's been such a long time since we've had a chance to talk about Iraq and all the lies that surround what's going on. So thank you for having me on.
Exactly. Well, it's really good to have you back. Let's start off by having you outline what's happening in terms of the elections in Iraq, what's going on with vote recounts, you know, everything in the context of the mainstream notion that the U.S. administration has finally installed democracy there. What's your thoughts on what's going on?
I mean, if I don't follow the news closely in Iraq, I can wake up this morning and really not even know that the elections took place. Nothing has changed on the ground. The elections are part of a theatrical democracy for television only kind of process that's been going on in Iraq since the American occupation in 2003. The Iraqi elections have been doubted now, the results of which have been doubted by all the major candidates in the elections, whether they are Iyad Alawi, Nouri al-Maliki, or other candidates that are not really in the running. The only people that seem to think that the election results are legitimate are the United Nations and the United States and the European Union. And, of course, all those three entities are sort of habitually calling elections legitimate in all occupied countries, whether it be Iraq or Afghanistan or in the occupied Palestinian territory under the foot of Israeli apartheid. So we really see, and we've been saying this now for a long time, that the election process in Iraq is theatrical, that democracy, in fact, cannot only exist within the confines of a ballot box, but there really has to be certain measures of dignified living that have to be in place in order for democracy to thrive. Democracy is not only elections as they are carried out on the television screens or on the elections posters and campaigns on the streets of Baghdad, but democracy is the ability of people to control the distribution of resources in their communities, to ensure that they have dignified access to their resources, and we're talking about the basic means of sustenance to this day. And we say this every time that we're on your show, Nora, that to this day, Iraqis suffer from access or the lack of access to water, electricity, healthcare, education, and without those kind of indicators being put on the ground, they can have an election every single day in Iraq, but that will not mean that there are any indicators that that country is heading towards democracy. As you mentioned in your introduction, what we saw after the elections is a return once again to car bombings, America now dropping more, you know, multiple ton bombs from the sky. We saw the leak of a disgusting video, a horrifying video of American soldiers using profanity and glorifying, picking off Iraqi civilians, many of whom were working as journalists or photojournalists in that instance. The situation in Iraq has remained the same. It is increasingly becoming more and more frustrating. The fundamental laws, the fundamental rules of what is being carried out in Iraq were determined by the 101 laws that were passed by Paul Bremer during his reign as the governor or the ruler of Iraq. We also see that Iraq still operates under sectarian rule, that there is still sort of a system that is really being played out along the lines that are defined within the Constitution, that clearly indicate that Iraq is only defined by the religious sects or the political sects that fall within that realm. There is no mention of Iraqis as being Iraqis. They're only described as sort of Sunnis or Shias or Kurds, and of course that plays in very well into the political process that is being undertaken in the country. And I think that it's very important for our viewers that see what's happening in Iraq to understand that these elections will not change some of the most important fundamental building blocks of the country, such as Order Number 39, which was put into place by Paul Bremer, that says that, you know, amongst many several debilitating regulations, Iraq will now have an economy that's completely privatized, including state-owned ventures, including full ownership of Iraqi businesses, including full ownership of infrastructure that would guarantee adequate health care, electrical power, clean water. These are things that are not going to be changed by the elections. Order number 81, that forbid Iraqi farmers from using locally cultivated seeds in agriculture. These will not be changed by the Iraqi cultures. What has happened, though, through the Iraqi cultures is now we're seeing the emergence of slumlords, thieves, and war criminals as political stars in the election process. This election process was fought out by Ayad Alawi, who's a notorious thug. In the 1960s, Ayad Alawi would walk around university campuses with a pistol in his hand and terrorize progressive activists on those campuses, activists that wanted a more progressive agenda for the country. Today, he is being touted as a hero of a so-called Iraqi democracy. He was fighting against an individual who has overseen armed militias, ethnically cleansed areas in Baghdad and throughout the country. In Iraqi Kurdistan, we see political power being divided by two opposing parties, their corrupt leadership, and the inner circles that surround them. So it's very clear that what's happening is that while the Iraqi government is busy recounting votes, what they should be really recounting is the 1.5 million dead bodies that we've seen in the sanctions on Iraq, and the almost 1 million bodies that have now piled up since the occupation. They should be counting the billions of dollars that have gone missing as a result of the most largest systematic theft that we've seen in modern history. But instead, they're fooling the people around the world by counting votes. But we're not fooled in Iraq, and we recognize that many of these people that are now sort of trying to tout themselves as liberators or as the vanguard of democracy are nothing more than thieves.
That's the voice of Ahmed Habib. Ahmed, let's take a look at the situation on the ground, what is not being reported by the establishment media a little bit more. Just about a week ago, as you mentioned, WikiLeaks released a U.S. military classified video of a battalion of American soldiers mowing down Iraqi civilians, including journalists, by Apache helicopter gunships. And as you mentioned, laughing about it on the walkie-talkies, using profanity, really no indication that they felt any remorse about killing innocent civilians. The U.S., of course, cleared the air crew of, quote, any wrongdoings. What has been the fallout in the Iraqi community, and what does this kind of leaked incident signify? I mean, this is not the only incident like this that has ever happened in Iraq during the last 7 years of occupation, nor during the 12 years of sanctions, nor during the first war against Iraq in the early 90s. What really does this signify, and what has the fallout been?
I mean, this sort of reminds me of winters that I spent in Toronto. It would be the equivalent of somebody telling me that the winter in Toronto is cold. I'd respond with a very sort of sober look and be like, of course the winter is cold. Iraqis have been terrorized by American policies for decades now, with sanctions and since 2003. Let's not forget that this same military has been accused of a litany of accusations, sexual assault, theft, to murder, to mass murder. And so Iraqis are no surprise to what's happening in place. I mean, our listeners should just realize that the video that we saw was just one video that was leaked, but this is the regular state of affairs with the American military in Iraq. You know, one can only take a look at some of the manuals that have been produced for the American military that have demonized the Iraqi people, that have spoken about the Iraqi people only as sects, that have really dehumanized the Iraqi people. In Fallujah, now we're seeing reports that sort of talk about the tremendous increase in the rates of child cancer, birth deformities. We're seeing again now, 13 years after the sanctions in the south of Iraq, an increase in child cancer rates. We know that the American government has historically stood behind atrocities that it has committed, has tried to whitewash them. And really, earlier, I want to touch back on something that you mentioned about Blackwater. The indictment of the Blackwater officials is the equivalent of indicting Al Capone for a traffic violation, for him going down for that. This is an absolute absurdity. Blackwater has been at the forefront of terrorizing Iraqi people, has been at the forefront of carrying out massacres against the people in Iraq, and for them now to go down for this kind of accusation is a real insult to the victims of Iraq and a real insult to the intelligence of American listeners and American taxpayers that, in fact, are paying for the murder of Iraqis. What we saw in the video is only a minute reflection of the reality that goes on in Iraq. American soldiers are on the ground. They are on the ground within the understanding that they are dealing with an enemy and not a civilian population. Many of these young men and women that American armed forces are carrying with them an entire appetite for racializing and xenophobia, and many of it, of course, is perpetuated by the tragedies of 9/11, and many of it are perpetuated by the outright racism that exists within the institution that is the American military. And, of course, people that are listening to you in your neighborhoods right now that are living under the feet of San Francisco police officers recognize what I'm talking about when I say institutionalized racism. Black youth in the Bay Area deal with the situation as well. So there's no doubt that in the United States, there's a systematic racism that runs through all these major law enforcement agencies. So it is with no doubt that the Iraqis are feeling the brunt of this. Iraqis, Afghans, Palestinians, and Israel. And this is not a surprise to anyone that deals with this situation. And I think it's important for us to recognize that this is the day-to-day reality that Iraqis are dealing with, whether it's at the hand of American soldiers directly or at the hand of American-trained or Iraqi government-supported armed militia thugs, murderers, or whether, as we see in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, under the feet of Israeli soldiers or American-trained security forces within the Palestinian Authority. There's no doubt that when we talk about occupation, it's not just a theoretical exercise, but we're talking about the taking over of a sovereign country. We're talking about the presence of hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground with rifles that maim, that cripple, that rape women, that obsess about the depiction of as civilians, as enemies, as savages. This is historic. This is not new. We see this throughout history. America has been at the forefront of this in the recent years, but this is something that indigenous peoples throughout the world have had to deal with that, including right there on Turtle Island in North America, where our listeners are right now.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to the situation in occupied Palestine. Fundamentalist Orthodox Jewish settlers attacked a Palestinian housing complex in the West Bank city of Ramallah today and inside a Palestinian community in Israel, in both incidents breaking into homes and announcing their plans to take over property. In Yaffa, south of Tel Aviv, settler groups stormed the house of Zainab Rahil, saying that they will force all Arabs out of Yaffa, telling the owner that the Arab presence in Yaffa is temporary and that all Arabs will be forced out of Israel. The International Middle East Media Center reports that the settlers later held prayers in front of the house, carrying Israeli flags and chanting racist slogans against Palestinians. The attack is one of many recent attacks in Yaffa, as the settlers are trying to create an outpost at the center of Al-Ajami neighborhood, the biggest Palestinian neighborhood in the city. Elsewhere in the West Bank, settlers uprooted at least 250 young olive trees in the northern region near Nablus, destroying acres of planted farmland and setting the trees on fire. And yesterday in Gaza, Israeli tanks fired shells into the city of Khan Yunus and Deir el-Balah, claiming that they were under fire from Palestinian resistance groups. Meanwhile, the fifth annual Conference on Popular Resistance began today in the West Bank village of Bila'in, which has been an infamous hotspot for nonviolent struggle against Israeli policies of apartheid, land confiscation, and settlement expansion. Joining us to talk about the conference and the general situation right now for Palestinians under occupation and state-sponsored racist violence is our special correspondent Jamal Juma'a. Jamal is the co-coordinator of Stop the Wall campaign based in the West Bank. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Jamal.
Hi, thank you.
So first off, let's talk about what's happening in terms of accelerated and rampant settler violence against Palestinians, not just in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, where we hear about this almost every day, but inside Israel as well. Talk about what Palestinians are facing as their homes are invaded on a regular basis from ultra-right-wing fundamentalist settler groups all across Palestine.
Yeah, first of all, I would like just to note that the settlers are not doing this by themselves, and they are not separated from the Israeli government policies and in the West Bank and Jerusalem, as well as you mentioned in your report, in Yaffa or other Palestinian places. This is a huge wave of racism and discrimination against the Palestinians that became now escalated more and more, from led by these fanatic groups, supported by the Israeli government, which is fanatic government. The attack on the Palestinians by the settlers, this is something long story. It's not from today, not from this year or the last year. Since they start attacking the Palestinian land, stolen it, and start building the settlements, this is the violations going on day after day. But it escalated. Nowadays, we can say that it's became much more organized. The settlers themselves in the West Bank became much more organized in a way that what we are witnessing is that they are formed almost their gangs and their groups, like a military organized military groups. Of course, this is totally backed up with the Israeli official soldiers and military, either in the cities, main cities like Hebron, Jerusalem, or in the villages around the main highways where the settlers and the settlements usually have major attacks on the Palestinians everywhere. This policies of attacking the people and they're burning their farms, uprooting their trees, attacking their houses, has been also accompanied with more confiscation of land and more declaration of building new settlements in the Palestinian areas and lands. So lately, like 1.5 months ago, the Israeli some Israeli monitor organization for the settlements, they announced about almost 70,000 housing units under planning by the Israeli government. Some 15,000 of them is now under construction. You know what does this mean? when you talk about 70,000 housing units beside the settlement that's already there, then you are talking about in total about around 1.2 million settlers will be located in the West Bank. This has been a major change with the demography of the West Bank, means that the settlers became main community in the West Bank, almost like close to the half of the population. This is one of the major crimes that is happening daily against the Palestinians, as the whole world will witness if the situation continues like this, the impact of this in the next few years, when everything became finished, no more space for any Palestinian state, and again, the international community has to deal with the Israeli de facto on the ground. I think this is, bring the whole situation to its limits. Either Israel stop all these violations immediately and by serious pressure from the international community, or the whole area will come back again to a circle of violence. It could be much more worse than the ones before. We can't, as a Palestinians, just watching everything stolen from under feet. Everything. No more land. No water. No security in your house. Your house is a threat of demolition. Your trees is uprooted. Your life is like totally abused every day. People lost their lives. The checkpoints make our lives like hell. They control every single thing in our life, contaminating our water in Gaza, besieging our people. There is slow genocide what's going on in Gaza. The big question, until when? Until when we are going to just keep be patient and keep waiting and the whole world is witnessing? There is a limit. It should be an end to this. The suffering of the people can't continue forever. Either the international community will hold Israel accountable for its crimes that they are committing, and also they also respect their guidance and their rules and their morals that they all the time like singing around the world of it, or just don't interfere and pressure the Palestinians, put more pressure on them and contribute to the image that the Palestinians is a terrorist. It's enough.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The International Middle East Media Center is reporting that Israeli occupation troops opened fire on nonviolent Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip earlier today in a demonstration against the Israeli-built separation wall at the southern border near Rafah. Meanwhile, Israeli bulldozers demolished Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank village of Halhul near Hebron, as the Israeli government claims that the houses were built, quote, too close to Route 60, a road that is used by Jewish settlers for travel between Jerusalem and illegal colonies in the southern West Bank. Today's home demolitions come on the heels of last week's demolition operations in three separate areas of the West Bank, displacing dozens of people in Al-Khadr, Beit Sahur, and Haras. Israeli policies continue to uproot people's lives all over occupied Palestine in a project of ethnic cleansing and displacement that has lasted over 62 years. Our next guest looks at the impact of forced removal and the uprooting of one Palestinian family through her most recent novel, Mornings in Jenin. Susan Abulhawa will be here in the San Francisco Bay Area later this week to read from that book. She's also the co-founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, an NGO that advocates for Palestinian children in Palestine and in refugee camps in Lebanon. She joins us now from Philadelphia. Susan Abulhawa, it's great to have you back on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora. It's good to be here.
So first off, let's talk about the current struggle for Palestinian refugees. We cover a lot of issues related to Palestine on the show, and within the daily horror stories unraveling from Palestine, the refugee issue remains at the crux of the matter. Talk about the challenge and the struggle for Palestinians today and why you've continued to focus on their stories.
The refugee issue is certainly one of the main Palestinian issues, but it's certainly... It's not the main one. I mean, it's hard to say which one is the crux. But certainly the dispossession of Palestinians, I mean, that's been the aim of Israel to just remove the entire non-Jewish native population of Palestine. I would say that is at the heart of this conflict. you know, it seems natural to focus on that dispossession as the source of this conflict. You know, I was just in Lebanon in Beirut recently, and we went through Nahr al-Bared. These camps where several generations of the original refugees still live aren't fit for human beings. And, you know, this is happening while Jews from all over the world pour into Palestine and are entitled to dual citizenship, while refugees languish in refugee camps and in exile and in the diaspora all over the world.
And as you said, people are still being made refugees today over and over again. We saw what happened in Gaza last year when people who were already refugees from the 1948 expulsion were made refugees, you know, sometimes for the fourth, fifth, sixth time. And then, of course, in Nahr al-Bared. Talk about kind of this continuous and ongoing displacement of people and what that does to identity and the overall Palestinian experience.
You know, I think that this repeated dispossession, this ongoing terrorizing of people in their homes, the sense that you have nowhere to go, nowhere to hide, when Israel just decides to rain death on you from the sky and bulldoze everything that you own, everything that you have. Everything that you are and you think of your future ends up packed underneath tank treads. It's devastating. It's devastating to individuals, to families, and to our society at whole. I mean, I feel like the Palestinian people are living in this this mass trauma. Families are unraveling. I mean, the situation, especially in Gaza, is unimaginable. The domestic violence has increased because, you know, this sense that everyone has a sense that there is nothing, there is no place to hide, there is no way to protect your children, there is no hope. It's hard to breathe is the sense that I get from people when I speak to them there. They're 80% of Palestinian kids in Gaza suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, that's a staggering, shocking figure, for that many children to have this crippling psychological syndrome that, grown men rarely recover from who come back from combat. And so it's not just the dispossession, it's the way that it happens. It's this constant terrorizing of people. And it's, Israel, when they speak about the refugees, they often, they talk about it as if this was something that happened in 1948 and we're not going to, go back. But the fact is, and like you said, and I'm glad you said that, it's ongoing. It happens every day. People are made homeless in the West Bank and in Gaza every day. Lives are destroyed every day. And it's, I've called it imperialism by the inch. It's the slow daily expulsion, this slow daily ruining of people's lives. And Israel can get away with it because this kind of stuff will fly under the radar. It's not this, this massive event that will call attention to them. And they've done this over years. And if you look at the maps from 1947 to now, you'll see that Israel is, in fact, wiping Palestine off the map, and they are uprooting everything that is Arab, everything that is Muslim, everything that is Christian from this holy land in this meticulously designed plan to turn Palestine, to turn that holy land into a place that is exclusive for Jews. And I think that you know, I think that flies in the face of everything that, as a race, we've strived to achieve over the centuries. You know, here in the U.S., we've fought wars and waged civil rights struggle to get rid of that kind of racism and exclusivity, and we do that with a claim to embrace pluralism and multiculturalism, and when these things actually were already present in Palestine before the establishment of Israel.
Reporting and interviewing for Flashpoints, I'm Evelina Molina. Arnoldo, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi.
Arnoldo, we'd like to talk a little bit about a situation, a massive roundup of migrant workers in Arizona. Can you give us a little bit of context of what's going on in Arizona? And also, can you bring it, what has happened in Arizona, and what does it mean to us in the rest of the country?
Well, there was a raid on Thursday, April 15th, that involved more than 800 federal, state, and local police agents that literally invaded four Arizona communities in Nogales, Rio Rico, Tucson, and Phoenix. And this was one of the largest dragnet operations that's been conducted by the Obama administration. And the ICE described it as, quote-unquote, targeting human smuggling networks. But this display of force was so tremendous, right? It sent shockwaves all across the communities there and also across the country. This raid also coincided with the day before the state legislature. They're passing a law that will give police the power just to stop anyone to question them about their immigration status, you know, for them to ask them for their immigration or citizenship papers. And also would allow citizens to sue any city, town, or county if they think the police is failing to enforce this law. And unfortunately, the governor of Arizona, people expect the governor to sign this really drastic measure that would exacerbate racial profiling.
And you're listening to Arnoldo Garcia. He is with the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And we're talking about the massive raid with over 800 ICE, and in collaboration with local police, rounded up about, I guess they rounded up, they say around 50. And Arnoldo, can you tell us the timing of this? It's very interesting. Here locally in Sonoma County, Secure Communities was implemented a few days, about a week before the census started. And we find that Operation Fugitive, which I understand is the operation of this massive sweep in four cities, happened on the last day of the census. Can you make some connections? What's going on with that?
There are several things going on. One is, of course, this really bad law that's like Prop 187. If people remember Prop 187, this is Prop 187 on steroids that gives, you know, power to detain people in a whole different way. It's a form of apartheid. If you know what the situation was in Africa under South Africa under apartheid, but it's more like Jim Crow segregation here for us in the United States in our history. But it adds a whole new dimension to it, right, because the law is going to codify what has been happening in Arizona for a long time already on the border generally. And the problem is that Arizona has become a laboratory for this type of really bad racist laws. And there are at least 10 states that are saying that they want to consider proposing such measures in their jurisdictions. So the problem is that a lot of this, the border literally follows people wherever you go. It doesn't matter if you look here in Oakland or Berkeley. It doesn't look very much different than South Tucson, where one of the places where the raid took place, where they were attacking a supposedly smuggling operation. But you know, 800 agents arrested 47 people. Most of them had they had arrest warrants for them, and then they swept up an additional 17 people who were just happened to be caught up in the mayhem of ICE. So they spent millions of dollars. And what was the purpose of this? This was a deliberate action to intimidate people and to scare them. And to put, and this makes them more vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. And this is, this really is the, we have to hold the Obama administration accountable for this, this action in particular, and all the other policies that they continue implementing. It's not a rogue agency. It's not a rogue, you know, agents. No, this is the policy of the U.S. government, and it's really a disaster for our communities.
And that is the voice of Arnoldo Garcia with the National Network for Immigrant Rights. Arnoldo, tell us a little bit, making the connections about, I remember about 4 years ago, the attention was on The End Game, which is a document created in 2003 under the Department of Homeland Security, which really outlines much of these tactics. Can you tell us a little bit, how does Secure Communities 287G, and what's going on with these massive fear tactics? How do they all work together?
Yeah, well, the raid that happened in Arizona and the law that's being passed, right, it's part of the climate that's being created nationally through the main plan, which is called Operation Endgame. It's supposed to end in 2012, and they've been implemented. Operation Endgame consists of three main things. One is that they're going to triple the interior enforcement policing. They're going to double the number of Border Patrol agents, which has already happened. And they're going to increase the capacity of jails, both locally and nationally, that are being built exclusively for immigrants. For example, in federal prisons, 75% of all Latinos who are in jail for no other crime than being undocumented. And federal jails only represent about 6% of the total prison population. So this becomes really drastic in state prisons, county, and local jails about who's being held there. There's a lot of there's 16 main prisons that are holding exclusively built for that are under the command of ICE, Department of Homeland Security, or in contracted out to like the GeoCorp or CCC. These are private prison corporations. So the Operation Endgame is in force, and you also see it in the Operation Fugitive. The Secure Communities and 27G programs, which are initiatives that allow local and state and county police to collaborate with immigration and law enforcement. And these are really dangerous, right, because these type of measures really undermine the stability and safety of communities, because who are you going to report to a crime like in Arizona or even here in Oakland or Berkeley if you think or you know the police has the power to detain you just based on believing that, suspecting that you might be undocumented or might be Latino, for the, you know, because that's what racial profiling is all about. If you look or sound or pass as an immigrant, usually it's that's a Latino, African, or Asian person, then you're going to be detained or questioned. So who are you going to report a crime to? Who are you going to report violence to, or that you're being robbed or so forth, if the people that are supposed to protect you can also detain you and have you deported? So the government is in a really creating a really tenuous situation for itself. It's undermining our rights, and it's also destabilizing our communities.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to New Orleans. 4.5 years after the devastating Hurricane Katrina, people across the city are not only dealing with the ongoing fallout of displacement and trauma, but an uptick in police violence as well. Our special correspondent Jordan Flaherty, author of the new book Floodlines, writes in the Huffington Post this week that the city's Black and transgender communities are facing rampant and systematic harassment and discrimination from the New Orleans police force, including sexual violence and arrest without cause. Flaherty writes, quote, members of the city's larger gay community complain about unwarranted arrests and a criminalization of sexuality, with police specifically targeting bars in the Black gay community. Advocates and community members also say that once gay men and transgender women are arrested for offering sex, they are more likely than others arrested in similar circumstances to be charged with a so-called crime against nature, a felony charge. Joining us to talk about the current situation in New Orleans is Jordan Flaherty. Jordan is the co-editor of Left Turn Magazine and, as I mentioned, the author of the brand new book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Genesis 6. Also joining us is Wendy Cooper, a community advocate and transgender health worker who is interviewed for Jordan's article. They both join us from New Orleans. Jordan and Wendy, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much, Nora. It's an honor to be on, and thank you for shining the light on this issue.
Well, thank you. And Jordan, let's start off with what you uncovered in your article. Talk about the general situation in New Orleans and what's happening to the Black and transgender communities in the city in the context of these attacks on people by the police.
Well, you're absolutely right to talk about the context of this. And you know, before getting to the specifics of the case, I just want to talk for a minute about the revelations that we've been seeing over the last 6 months of behavior of the police force. Especially, you have in those first days after Katrina, there was a massive amount of police violence. They're basically given carte blanche to do what they want with no investigations afterwards for several years. And you had the media, the local media, not looking into it. You had the district attorney's office not looking into it. You had the U.S. attorney not looking into it. And, you know, it wasn't until years later that A.C. Thompson did a story in the Nation. And after the election of Barack Obama, Eric Holder's Justice Department started looking into cases. And the revelations have been shocking. On 4 days after Katrina, you had Henry Glover, a Black man in the West Bank of New Orleans, who was shot by one officer, then apparently taken hostage by other officers who either killed him directly or burned him alive. His burned remains were found weeks later. On September 2nd, Danny Brumfield Sr., a 45-year-old man stranded with his family at the New Orleans Convention Center, was deliberately hit by a police car, then shot in the back by police in front of scores of witnesses as he tried to wave down the officers to ask for help. On September 4th, 2 days later, a group of police officers drove up to several unarmed civilians on the Danziger Bridge who were fleeing their flooded homes and opened fire. Two people were killed, including a mentally challenged man named Ronald Madison, and four were seriously injured. Madison was shot in the back by one officer, and another officer ran up to him, started kicking and stomping on him, apparently, until he was dead. So, you know, these cases have been coming to light in the headlines in the last weeks and months. And there's more than ever before, or at least in decades in the city, there's a real public outcry for changes in the police department. And in the context of these, we've been hearing these revelations about the violence against especially folks in the Black, gay, and trans community. And that's what this article talks about. That people have been saying that just a pattern of abuse, as you mentioned, people basically arrested just for being Black and gay or trans, and then charged with prostitution charges. Oftentimes they're charged with what incredibly is called a crime against nature, a law that we still have on the books that officers, have interpreted to mean any a sexual act of oral or anal sex. They charge people generally on prostitution of it, but it's disproportionately used against gay folks and trans folks. And once they are charged with that, if they're convicted or if they plead to it, they have sex offender written on their driver's license, they have to register as sex offenders, and they're in the sex offender database for 10 years.
That's the voice of Jordan Flaherty. He's talking about a new article that he wrote about what's happening in New Orleans, specifically to the Black and transgender communities there. And Jordan, before we turn to Wendy, can you talk about some of the specific incidents that you've uncovered in which this absurd and homophobic felony charge of what they're calling crimes against nature is applied to people in New Orleans, and what's being done to challenge this law in court?
Well, you have in the database, of several hundred people. I think about a third of the folks in the database are folks that are charged for prostitution. So about a third of the folks that are registered sex offenders, which we usually think of as child molesters, about a third of them are people busted on prostitution charge, and of that, a disproportionate amount are gay and trans folks that were arrested on these prostitution charges. Once they're charged with this crime against nature charge, there's all sorts of other restrictions. For example, if there's a hurricane and they need to evacuate to a shelter, they have to go to a shelter that's just for sex offenders. So it's basically these sex workers and then convicted child molesters at this shelter. they, you know, they're not allowed to, you know, there's small limitations, like they can't wear a costume at Mardi Gras, you know, absurd limitations like that. If folks are parents, they can't get within a certain range of a school, so they can't, you know, pick up their kids from school. All kinds of limitations that they face. And there is a coalition of organizations working on this. One of the main conveners has been Women with a Vision, which is a women's healthcare organization, and they've been working with organizations like the Insight chapter of the local chapter of Insight Women of Color Against Violence, what's called the Women's Health and Justice Initiative here, who have been organizing and fighting on this issue, members of Critical Resistance, the New Orleans chapter of Critical Resistance, and other folks have been trying to organize and come together on this issue. And more and more of the people who have been victimized by this have been speaking out and coming out and organizing around this.
All right, Wendy Cooper, let's turn to you. Talk about what you've experienced as a member of the trans community in New Orleans and how you've been treated by the police.
I've been discriminated behind the sex since I've been characterized as a child predator, child molester. It's kind of heartbroken. I mean, I really don't like too much to talk about or whatever, because it hurts me so much, because I'm labeled as something that I'm really not, you know. And when I have to go register as a sex offender, you know, they read these laws to me, like that I was dealing with a child and there was something that I wasn't doing, you know. It prohibits me from doing a lot of things, my education, you know, working. It's hard for me to get a job. It's hard for me to get employment. It's hard for me to get an apartment on my own because of the fact that I am a sex offender. And when I try to explain the charge to different people, you know, it's like it's a lie, you know. And sex offender itself is so strong because you see, you know, men on TV soliciting on computers, trying to solicit children and stuff, and it's hard right now. And it's real hard for me. But at the grace of God, you know, I managed to go these 4 years to graduate from college, but I have a degree and I can't do nothing with it because of the sex offense.
Wendy, I know that for other people in the trans community in New Orleans, as Jordan described in his article, some of them are actually forced into sex by police officers themselves when they're picked up on the street.
Oh, that's many times.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe people that you've heard of or have witnessed this happening, and what impact that creates on the trans community there?
Well, first of all, you know, when someone gets stopped like me as being a transgender by a police officer, the first thing that to me is like that name, that charge. I feel like the state tries to be so hard on sex offenders with their it's like they advertise, and you know, okay, this person was convicted of crime against nature. And it's like they're charged like an advertisement. So when the police stops you, you know, I had an incident where the police stopped me and I had been beaten. And they used the sex offender law to try to scare me or whatever. So what happened was I was beaten or whatever and I was taken to jail. And the police had let me go. Well, when I got in jail, they had let me go. They gave me, like, a traffic ticket. So when I got the traffic ticket, whatever, as soon as I left, they was asking me all kind of questions. Do I have a vagina? Do, you know, how you have sex? And, you know, they making these comments while I was in a jail cell. So when I was released from out of jail that same night, I left. The police had followed me home, and I had to present oral sex on him. Well, he was going to take me to jail again.
He demanded oral sex from you?
Demanded oral sex.
Is there any way that, I mean, this is, of course, an unbelievable story, but I know that it happens all the time, and people here, of course, in the San Francisco Bay Area, I'm sure are shocked to hear this, that it's happening, you know, in today's day and age in a major metropolitan city like New Orleans against an already marginalized community. Where can people go to feel safe, and how are you able to defend your civil rights under these types of draconian, racist, and homophobic laws?
I just have to stay home, you know. It's nothing that I really can do because I'm scared if I go somewhere or if I stay out too late or if I even be around children, you know, it scares me, you know. I mean, actually, I really don't know what to do. Then the best thing for me to do is, like, to stay home. You know, I'm scared to go around children. I'm scared to be around a child. Or if I see a child, I'd be like, I don't even look at a child, you know, in a way. And here, I'm a sex offender. And I'm still at this moment, I just can't believe that I'm a sex offender, you know, because it's so scary now, you know. It's just scary. So my best thing is I stay home.
That's the voice of Wendy Cooper. She's speaking to us from New Orleans, and also on the line with us is Jordan Flaherty. And we're speaking about this really shocking turn of events in New Orleans. And Jordan, how do these types of systematic attacks on the Black and transgender communities fit into the general context of violence that spreads from the state down to the people who are trying to repair their lives in New Orleans 4 years, almost 5 years after the hurricane, who have already dealt with so much? And now their sexuality, their gender is also under attack.
You know, Nora, in that period after Katrina, you saw the people of New Orleans criminalized. You know, there is some sympathetic media coverage, but very quickly the media coverage began. These are criminals, they're looters, they're, you know, on welfare, all sorts of ways in which people were criminalized. And you saw the relief become very militarized. And it became basically, people were dehumanized. It became okay to do anything to the people of New Orleans, especially poor people, especially Black people from New Orleans. Now, this targeting of the Black transgender community goes back to before Katrina, you know. But I think that the context of Katrina is really important, where we really had this moment where police, it became okay for police to do whatever they wanted. And we are now in a moment where people are starting to realize what came from that. And these revelations are starting to come out of how people have been treated. And there seems to be really a moment where we can change things, where the federal government is looking into making sweeping changes, and is every day, or at least every week, there's another new investigation that the federal government opens up. And what we hope will happen is that the Justice Department will look into specifically these cases, will look into the way the New Orleans Police Department has been treating the Black, gay, and trans community, and will start investigating these cases. I think that we need real federal supervision over the police department, and we need it on a sweeping level that not only looks into the police department, but looks into the district attorney's office, the U.S. attorney's office, the coroner's office, which has been, you know, in cases of police violence and police murder, backing up the police story even against all available evidence. So we really need sweeping changes, and we need a major investigation. And I really encourage your listeners to contact the Justice Department and to tell them to look into this story. I encourage people to forward this story onto people and spread the word, because if we can get the word out about this and get these investigations going, I think this is a real moment where you can have a real change.
Well, finally, Wendy, if you had 10, 15 minutes with the U.S. Attorney General to talk about the conditions in which the trans and gay community, especially Black trans and gay community members, are being treated in New Orleans, what would you say to him?
You need to stop. You know, I just feel like that, you know, we shouldn't be targeted, you know, gay people shouldn't be targeted as sex offenders. You know, I just feel like that we just shouldn't. And it needs to come to an end. It needs to come to an end. You know, I'm tired of living my life like this. I'm tired of living my life as a sex offender that I am not, you know. And maybe it might not help me, but I hope it helps others, you know. I really don't know, because I'm kind of depressed about it right now.
Understandably. Well, finally, Jordan, I wanted to let people know about your book, Floodlines. You know, this story is one of many that you've immersed yourself in the years after Katrina and even before. In your book, Floodlines, you interviewed people from all corners of the New Orleans community, musicians, transgender folks, artists, writers, indigenous activists, advocates for civil rights, to weave a portrait of a city in transition, a city under the weight of poverty and the politics of racism and displacement. tell us a little bit about your book and why people like Jeff Chang has said it captures the urgency of New Orleans and its survival as one of the most important battles for justice in our time.
Well, thank you, Nora. You know, I think that there's a lot that people around the country can learn from New Orleans. There's outrageous things like this story that we've been talking about here, but there's also a lot that's been really inspiring. There's been incredible community organizing, really brave folks like Wendy and other folks I talk about in the article who have been speaking out and who have been, you know, really willing to take action and fight this. And the fact that we have this opening to change the police department in New Orleans came because of grassroots activists and organizing and people standing up and fighting back against horrible, horrible circumstances and in horrible situations. And I think that there's a lot that's been incredibly inspiring in this resistance that we've seen in these last few years in New Orleans. And, you know, I'm a little speechless right now. I just, you know, I want to really compliment, you know, or praise Wendy for just how brave she's been, you know, to speak out on these issues and to fight on these issues. And I just, you know, I think we really need justice for, you know, for folks like Wendy and other folks in this community who've been facing this. You know, I don't know if it was, you know, clear from this conversation, if it needs being said again, but these are folks arrested, you know, on a prostitution charge, and they are forced for 10 years, sometimes 15 years, 20 years, to register as sex offenders, to be in a sex offender database, to have sex offender printed on their driver's license, you know, and that interferes with all sorts of things, from housing to employment to other things, and I just, you know, I think it's so criminal the way people have been treated, and you know, once somebody is marked in this way, they become, you know, outside society, and you know, it gives the police even more freedom to do what they want with them. And that's what we've seen. You know, we've just seen a massive abuse of power, and so, you know, thank you to Wendy for fighting against this power, and thank you to Nora for you know, helping amplify these voices.
Well, thank you, Jordan, for putting the story out there and continuing to really beat the drum of resistance and civil society in your town of New Orleans. And Wendy Cooper, thank you. You know, I echo what Jordan said. It's an outrageous story. It's unbearable to hear. And I really respect you so much for coming on Flashpoints today and being
Thank
so
you.
Honest and upfront about what you're facing. And we're going to try and make this bridge of solidarity from the West Coast to New Orleans right now. Can you give us some information of Women with a Vision, the organization that is helping to defend civil rights in New Orleans?
Yeah, people can find them on the web at wwav-no for Women with a Vision New Orleans .org. And people can find links to you know, the full story and links to Women with a Vision and other organizations fighting on this issue if they search my name on Huffington Post or any of several other places. They'll be able to find the article and find the links to these organizations working on these issues.
Wonderful. And we'll also link the article on flashpoints.net. Okay, Jordan Flaherty of Left Turn and Huffington Post and the author of Floodlines, thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints. And Wendy Cooper, thank you again so much for standing up and speaking out and being with us also on Flashpoints today.
Okay.
Thank you again, Nora. Thank you, Wendy.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.